The other thing that I think impacted some of our challenges was trying to figure out how to create policies and expectations around what remote or hybrid work looked like, and balancing having a leadership team that was like very anti-remote, even though they knew that that was something they had to adapt to.
When we're talking about AI in the world of HR and the world of talent acquisition, the debate often becomes, is this going to be an AI on autopilot world, an AI empowered world, or an AI enabled world? And where you fall in those buckets can depend on your personal experiences. In today's conversation with Amanda Woodard, what we're going to do is actually look at how there are two transformations that had to be navigated in a world where an organization was moving from a fully on-site to a hybrid world in the fintech space. And when you think about fintech as a sector, this is a sector that moves at a glacial pace. So the idea of innovating within AI and the idea of transforming a culture that is dominantly on-site to hybrid or remote is a tough task in and of itself. But what happens when you're trying to make those transformations and at the same time you're seeing advances in technology go a direction which makes it really easy for fake candidates to come in through the pipeline and potentially expose your organization to risk and even compromise? Those are some real dangers and risks that need to be examined, which creates the case that you need to have tight processes that allow you to capture the highest quality candidates while still having a decent volume of candidate flow that you can successfully fill the roles that you have. This is a story about how AI is empowering organizations versus AI that is coming in to take over and run the organization on autopilot. And the person leading us through that story is Amanda Woodard. She is the Senior Director of HR at Submittable. Amanda thrives at the intersection of strategy and sarcasm because someone has to. She's a jet setter, taco enthusiast, devoted dog mom, and avid music lover, often spotted at emo and pop punk shows. Amanda's built a career out of channeling anxiety into proactive planning and calling it strategy when it all works out. Amanda, excited to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jen.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be pretty interesting, especially for me as a former recruiter. I think we're going to get into a lot of areas that's going to be pretty interesting when we look at it from a TA perspective. But before we dive into that, I think it's important for you to set the stage a little bit and share with us a little bit about your background overall and also what we all know the world of talent acquisition to be, and what you've seen over the years in talent acquisition, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, sure. So high level a little about me, my career, interestingly enough, started in customer success and account management. So I wasn't even an HR or TA person by trade. I happened into it one time when we were trying to scale for a really large client at a company I was working at, and it worked really well. And ended up taking talent acquisition over at that part. Talent acquisition ended up being the doorway into HR for me. And that has just carried my career forward since probably 2018 to where I am today, where I am head of HR for a software company called Submittable. When we think about talent acquisition and you know where it was when I started versus how it's progressed, we have probably a few seasons, right? There's pre-pandemic when we're still bringing people in on site. At least in my experience, video interviews were a lot less common. And then we have post-pandemic. That was all we did for a really long time. We saw a ton of people getting into talent acquisition and we had recruiters everywhere. And we saw sometimes the market was up and it was easy to get a job, and we've seen where the market was down and it was difficult to get a job. And so I think the way that we strategize how to get around that looked very different than it does for me now. We had to do a ton of sourcing strategy. We had to be really proactive about reaching out to candidates and making sure that we were aligning with those ideal profiles. It took a lot more whining and dining to get people to bite and be interested in the organization and the role. It was still a lot more proactive. And then it has started to shift where we saw fewer companies hiring. We started to see a ton of layoffs. We saw that impacting our friends in the talent acquisition in the HR space. And it just dipped from there.
Really interesting landscape, Amanda. There's several things that caught my attention as you were talking through it. And I think one of the things that I'm most interested in is going back to your origin story where you came from customer success into HR. And that's a unique journey. What were your observations moving from a revenue side of the organization into more of an admin or cost center of an organization, making that transition from customer success to HR? That had to be a pretty significant change of pace. So what were your observations and how did you apply those observations to optimize the function?
I love that question because it touches on something that I'm super passionate about, which is looking at HR and your people strategy as a revenue generating function as opposed to being a cost center, which is viewed traditionally. I think because I had so much exposure to what the revenue process looked like from a sales perspective and the customer lifecycle journey and all of the pieces that went into acquiring a new client and then retaining them, a lot of it translated really nicely into talent acquisition. And so quite frankly, it was a pretty smooth transition once I realized that I could apply almost all of the processes that I had for what I was doing on a sales side to what I was doing from a TA side. It helped. We were able to apply a ton of stuff to our sourcing strategy. We were able to apply it to retention. We were honestly like just used it to operationalize our talent acquisition and then our HR practice altogether. So it is not a common career progression, but it is one that has served me very well, I think, because I had that revenue experience and also just the business acumen operationally that a lot of times I think HR people get robbed of getting exposure to.
Interesting. So the other thing that caught my attention was that you've been in HR across sort of three different eras, pre-pandemic, the pandemic era, and post-pandemic. And as somebody that came out of the agency recruiting world, I've been through those three eras as well. And I've also been in the pre-housing crash, housing crash, and post-housing crash era too. So it seems like people of a certain age are just dealing with economic crashes and figuring that stuff out. What I am interested in getting your perspective on is when you look at the pandemic and pre-pandemic era of talent acquisition, what was the typical operating rhythm? What were the challenges that you were dealing with in those two spots? And how did you respond to those challenges and adapt your organization to meet what was required at the time?
Yeah. Pre-pandemic, the organization was still very much on site. And there were certain areas of the business that were geographically dispersed or remote. But for the most part, we were all in one HQ area, which really limited my talent pool. So the ways that we would go out and try to find talent for early career people, I literally was walking around Nordstrom with business cards and handing them out to people that I thought had potential for like early career customer service roles. And for some of the more technical roles where they were able to be remote, I was just doing weird stuff like Googling phone system repairs and then calling and trying to make relationships with people that had alignment in the work that we were doing. At the time, LinkedIn was a thing, but the type of technical talent that I was recruiting, which is voice and data engineers, didn't have a ton of presence on LinkedIn. So we had to find different ways to go out and find that talent. It was very much network related, people network related, and who do you know and how can you leverage that to find other people for those roles? And then how do we find people to take roles that we need on site because we had no flexibility there? Post-pandemic, that flipped kind of everything, which was great in terms of having a much wider pool of talent that we could talk to. But I think one of the areas where the organization I was with at the time really struggled with was figuring out how to adapt to changing employee expectations and requirements. And so then it became more challenging because if you weren't competitive with work from home or remote, flexible work, if you had really stringent requirements on what do you do if your kid's in daycare and you work from home, those types of things made it really difficult and to be creative, and that impacted our sourcing and recruiting strategy for sure. And then this is also where I started getting more process focused and bringing in some of the stuff that I had done on a sales team in terms of creating pipeline and looking at email campaigns and things like that, and really just having to figure out how to apply those kind of technical process chops to sourcing and talking to candidates that I hadn't struggled with before.
Got it. So when I think through what you're describing, and I can relate to kind of everything that you're talking about, when you're dealing with a primarily on-site environment, your talent pool is restricted to maybe a 20-mile radius around where your headquarters is. And that has an implication on your employee value proposition and your employer value proposition. How do you sell a particular role or a company where you have a commute? Now, in the pandemic and post-pandemic era, the implication of having wider talent pools is that you get better overall talent and you have access to more talent overall as well. And it should make the job easier, but it doesn't really work out that way, does it? So tell us a little bit about some of the things that popped up as we transitioned from a mainly on-site, geographically bound hiring strategy to a hybrid or remote, and in some cases, international talent strategy. What did you start seeing?
Competition got so fierce, which did surprise me because now everybody has access to a wider talent pool. And so you would think that there would be great talent to go around for everyone. But as is with the case even now, people want to work for great companies, and benefits and total compensation packages and all of those things are contributing factors to what that looks like for an employee when they take a job. And so if you are not a FANG company and you're in the tech space and maybe you're a small voice and data provider and you're not Accenture, like, you can't compete with some of the things, like from a compensation or benefit standpoint, that those other organizations can't either. The other thing that I think impacted some of our challenges was trying to figure out how to create policies and expectations around what remote or hybrid work looked like, and balancing having a leadership team that was like very anti-remote, even though they knew that there was something they had to adapt to. And so there was very much this sense of like control that was perceived as, we don't trust our employees. And that made it really difficult for us to be competitive in the talent landscape as well, because people would have questions about flexible work and just work-life balance and all of those things. And that was another area where we really struggled to compete at first, because it was very much like, okay, yes, you can work from home, but you are expected to be in your chair from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. and the little green dot has to be on. And if we can't ping you, then it's probably because you're mowing the lawn. And so that was something that also ended up working against us, where we were trying to influence something that was happening to the business operationally, but was directly impacting your ability to attract top talent.
So it's interesting that you're navigating both a talent strategy transformation, and it sounds like you had to navigate sort of a cultural transformation as well. Because oftentimes what I've found in talking with other HR leaders is that those organizations that have senior and executive leadership that pushes back against remote or hybrid structures usually have some gaps in terms of overall leadership style and competency, and management style and competency as well. Looking back at that time, is that what you observed? And if it is what you observed, how did you actually triage that aspect of the organizational challenge while at the same time dealing with the talent sourcing strategy transformation that you're dealing with?
I think there's a few things there. One of the things that I did not connect back then that I wish I would have was honestly generational differences in work styles. I definitely uncovered some new leadership gaps in some areas where we needed to tighten up, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I don't know that it's always fair to put everyone in that bucket when a lot of it sometimes is simply perception because of a generation. And so at the time, all of our C-suite were boomers. Our senior leadership was Gen X, and then we didn't have the millennials in the workforce quite yet. So the rest of us were millennials, and we were still super entitled. And we had these like preconceived notions of that. And so I think a lot of it was generational, and I still run into that today. But one of the other things that we did uncover is just how much micromanagement was happening. And as a result of that, it's just like surprising how much we realized our productivity was being impacted. And it really was like a top-down trust issue. And one of the challenges that created for me was when we would go to open a new role, getting approval to have it be on site versus remote, if it had traditionally been on site, is really where we started to untangle all of those things. And so that's where we started having the conversations of, okay, but why does it have to be on site? What are you worried about that it isn't going to be successful? Doing some pros and cons. And at the time, I was also responsible for learning and development. So that also was like, okay, we need to do some work on our middle management, just leadership foundations and building trust. And then I needed to be able to leverage my influence to say, okay, just let me try this a couple of times. And if it's successful, then we can reevaluate how we make that decision. And if it's not, then we'll just go back to doing it the way you wanted. And we were able to make it successful for the most part.
So it's interesting that you're describing this, and I'm hearing a little bit of risk that you're taking because you're sticking your neck out and trying to fight the dominant culture within the organization that's resistant to this sort of change. And you finally get momentum in the right direction. But the thing that I think about is even before you're dealing with heavy remote staff. I was running a agency recruiting firm for a metro market, and all of our candidates were generally within the metro market area, but there would be people that had 40 minutes commutes into where we were located. So we would just take a remote interview that way instead of having them come in. But even in those instances, we ran into issues where people were having stunt doubles in those environments, and you would get a different person showing up in the interview process, even in those local environments. So you've gotten momentum and stuck your neck out, and you've gotten some buy-in to move people in the direction of opening up the candidate pool, being more open to remote candidates. But even in an environment where you were interviewing more locally, you still had to have strong processes in there that you could vet out candidates on a real basis and validate that their skills met the role. How did you navigate that challenge in a more remote recruiting environment where that becomes a lot tougher? What did you encounter and what did you do to combat that?
We learned a lot of lessons along the way. I can tell you that. We learned quickly that leveraging video over phone calls whenever possible was something that was important. I learned that candidates didn't really know immediately how to be part of a remote interview at the beginning. So in some ways, I felt like we were also training candidates on how to show up for an interview. And then we also had to just really adjust the way that we looked at structural interviews and get really smart about the behavioral questions that we were asking. And that is also about the time when we started implementing online technical assessment or any sort of like testing that we would have for technical roles to give us a good indication of, you know, skill proficiency, which in at the end of the day, honestly, gave us a better indication of whether or not someone was going to be successful in the role prior to what we were doing when it was in person and it was, you know, more intuitive.
So you put more process in, but I want to wind back just a little bit into what led to those processes being put in. Because one of the things that I encountered at the beginning of the pandemic and even before that is that when we would have virtual interviews with candidates that weren't geographically limited to our area, you would often have one person on camera and somebody else like feeding answers or acting as a stunt double or something like that. So to the point where we had instances where people who showed up at the work site were different than the ones that we interviewed. So when you expand that out from a virtual interview setting, did you experience that? And what sort of controls did you put in as a result to mitigate the risk of somebody showing up that wasn't the actual person that you interviewed?
It's funny that you ask that because I think for whatever reason, we were extremely lucky that in my entire TA career, we never had that happen, either with on-site or remote people or even across the multiple organizations that I've worked for. And you saying that just really reinforces that I was way too trusting for a long time because I wasn't even aware that was something that was happening. Until very recently, when we started hiring quite a bit again, and we were just completely overwhelmed and inundated with the number of candidates that we were receiving for some of our open roles. And at that point, we were like, okay, we have to pivot our strategy again. We're a small team. We don't know how to get through all of these applications. I started kind of asking around in some different forums that I am a part of, like, what are some things that you guys can do? Like, how are you leveraging AI to get through this? And while we did figure that out, one of the other things that came up was someone shared an FBI article with me about just bad actors that were posing as candidates and then turning laptops or company access over to North Korea. There's recently a Forbes article talking about this as well. There's tons of just different aspects of fraudulent activity that is occurring today above and beyond just the typical 25% of people lie on their resume type of thing. And it's scary.
This has been a fantastic conversation so far. If you haven't already done so, make sure to join our community. We're building a network of the most forward-thinking HR and people operations professionals who are defining the future. I will personally be sharing news and ideas around how we can all thrive in the age of AI. You can find it at gocleary.com/cleary-community. Now back to the show.
So when you have a couple of these things that are popping up at a national level, where you're talking about foreign bad actors potentially compromising internal systems with, you know, fake candidates and whatnot, but you referenced there are ways that you can leverage AI as a countermeasure against that. So what are some of the things that you've learned or done to combat the risk of that?
Yes. So first, I'm going to start with a hot take. Everybody has been completely inundated with everyone in their LinkedIn messaging getting blown up about, oh, we have AI to do this. We have AI to do that. And let's be real. Most of the time, it's not AI. It's just automation. And I'm not knocking automation because that has saved my biscuits like a ton of time. But let's be clear that automation and AI are not the same thing. One of the things that we have done was filtering and reverse filtering, which isn't really an AI thing, but being able to then score candidates based off of skills and things that are on their resume or not on their resume is one thing that we were able to leverage AI for. And that significantly reduced the amount of time that we had to spend just in the application review part. There are some other more tactical old school things that we actually implemented to help encourage people not to apply if they were fake, like taking away easy apply on LinkedIn, for example, and making people actually fill out an application and having the application have drop downs and checkboxes and long text and short text so that it would be more difficult for a bot to fill it out. And then keyword search, like I mentioned. One of the other things that we would do is reverse keyword search. So if there were specific skills or specific parts of the tech stack or something that we wanted to look for that maybe wasn't included in the job description, we would search for those and then aggregate that versus what we had done from our original filter to try to get down to viable candidates.
So that's at the application stage. What changes or processes did you implement at the interview stage to make sure that candidate quality remained high?
Yeah, so now we have multiple levels of ID verification. And you think of it as multiple gates as you go through the process. The first gate is a digital ID footprint verification. And so that's just taking basic information, name, phone number, email address, and cross-referencing against your digital profile experience, if you will, checking for things like, what is your phone carrier? Is your email actually an email that is connected to something else that you would use on an application in the internet? Do you have consistent activity that you would expect to see with a real human on things like LinkedIn? And then looking at geolocation. So you told me you were in Ohio. Does your IP address actually reflect that you're in Ohio? Now, we don't get the readout on all of like who your cell phone carrier is or what apps or accounts you have or any of that. That's not important. But really what we're looking for is like an authenticity score that says, based off of everything we see and can scrape from the internet, it looks like you are who you say you are. The second gate is where we do like a photo ID verification. And that comes across as a link before you do a video interview. So at this point, a candidate would have gone through application and a recruiter screen. And now they're probably going to talk to a hiring manager. They're somewhere in the interview loop. And it's just a link before they join a Google Meet. And then they're asked to show a picture of a photo ID, any sort of government issued ID. And then we have a third party system that will run that through and check to make sure that it's not fake, that the person in the photo ID is also the person represented on the video. That has, I think, helped us get away from having to do some of the awkward deep fake tests. Like I call it the John Cena, when you're trying to make sure that you don't see someone having a, you know, face overlay that's not theirs. The third check is a reference check. Obviously, like we do care about like past performance, but also everyone knows that no one's going to give a reference. That's a bad reference. So what we're really looking for in that situation is that the contact information that we've been given matches the organizations that are on the candidate's resume where they said they worked. And then we're also doing a side-by-side comparison of geolocation like that. For example, maybe we would run into someone who has multiple email addresses and they are their own reference. And to try to get around it, they talk to us on an iPhone and they email us from a PC. But their IP address is all similar or the same. So we know that they're in the same like geolocation. Or maybe one or all of them are not in the geolocation at all. Maybe they said they were in Utah and they are in fact in Bangladesh. And so those are some other areas that we get some insight into. And then the last step is a background check.
So when I hear all of this, some of this sounds like pre-hire. Some of this sounds like it might be conditional to hire. But I'm listening to the steps and I get it from the employer side of it. I'm thinking about it from the candidate side and I can't take my recruiter, agency recruiter hat off. I'm thinking about two things. Candidate experience has got to be rough. It's triggering my creep factor alert. Right. Hey, this is really intrusive and I don't even know if I have a job yet. And you're giving me a full out like NSA check. And then the third part of it is, all of the benefits that you get from being a remote or hybrid organization, being able to recruit from bigger talent pools, that shrinks it back down because a lot of people are, even if they are viable candidates, which there's going to be a good chunk of viable candidates are going to be like, I'm not going through all of that. Screw this place. So how did you balance the need for proper process while still maintaining a decent enough candidate flow to justify that, hey, one of the big reasons why we want to go remote is have bigger access to a candidate pool.
Yeah. It seems so creepy, right? I think, honestly, like that's still something that I am still struggling with a little bit, because I put myself, if I were a candidate, are those steps that I would want to go through. It doesn't feel great to be going through an interview process and to feel like I'm already like not trusted or like illegitimate. For us, honestly, what we do is we talk candidates through it up front, and we're just very transparent about it. So we have information on our careers page and in the job application process that, like, this is our stance on AI. These are our guidelines. This is when it's okay to use it. This is when it's not. This is how we use it. And then similarly, because of the nature of our business and because we want to protect our clients and our employees, and because of the landscape today, we're going to have multiple layers of ID verification. And so far, I haven't had anyone tell me to pound sand. I'm sure it's coming, but so far it hasn't. So we talk about it. It's there in the application process for you to review. We also talk about it quite a bit in the phone screen process. And I think one of the things that's been able to help us lessen the intensity feeling of it is by connecting why we are doing this process back to how it could impact the business. And so, for example, my company is shuffling billions of dollars around on an annual basis through government funding. When candidates hear really big numbers like that and they are able to understand like, oh, yeah, the type of information that I could potentially have access to could be detrimental if it were in the hands of a bad guy. I think it doesn't make it any less intense, but it's OK. Yeah, I can get my head wrapped around that. And this is like a standard protocol that makes sense. And if I were applying for any fintech company, I should probably expect to see something along those lines.
So I want you to zoom out a little bit. So we've been really heavy in sort of the specific use case that you've been talking about, your company within that sector in the age of post-pandemic hybrid and remote work, and how you actually navigate that environment where there is a lot of candidate side potential for fraud. So when you look at all of the things that you can do from a candidate perspective to game the system, and you're advising other TA leaders and other HR leaders about systems of control that you want to put in place in the age of AI and the age of deepfakes, what are the key action items that you would recommend for those folks to have in place, regardless of sector, to make sure that they are getting who appears to be, they're getting the same person that they're looking at on paper in person?
That's a great question. I think the good news here is a lot of the main, like the biggest ATSs are like already reacting to this. There is already going to be opportunities to help combat this innately, likely in tech stacks that we're already using. So if you are running background checks, we use Checker, and they are getting ready to launch something that does a lot of what I just described as part of the background check process. Greenhouse announced a partnership with Clear. There's a few others that are in the works. I think Bright Hire might be one. And I think a lot of that will include some sort of biometric scan during part of the video interview process. So I think the good news is that the tools that we use on a day-to-day basis to help us hire top talent is reacting quickly and trying to get tools out there that we can use that help combat this. So you don't have to do quite so many manual steps. In the meantime, I do think that anything that you can do to try to qualify or disqualify talent through the application process, leveraging filters and skills, and if you can do candidate scoring, I think that's a great way to help optimize the process. And you will find very quickly, if you're not already doing this, to how much just fake stuff is already out there. For example, I have never seen so many resumes from folks that have PhDs in petroleum engineering from the University of Cameroon. They must have a really strong program. I don't know why they want to be software engineers, but there you go. So that's if early on in the process. And then I think some sort of ID verification is important, whether you re-implement reference checks of some kind or background checks if that's part of your process. I think something along those lines needs to be part of the process now, even if you don't have access to check like geolocation and IP addresses and things like that. There is some kind of fishy behavior that these folks typically will let on throughout the process. And so I think just knowing that they're going to have to go through those steps is going to help deter the ones that maybe aren't super proficient professionals in the fraud space quite yet.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think the one thing that I would throw out there that's more of an analog process is to go really old school. And when you're interviewing people, interview using the outcome-based recruiting questions that Lou Adler is famous for. And that helped me catch a lot of people that were trying to like fluff their resume with stuff that they didn't actually do. This has been a great conversation, and I appreciate you hanging out with us, Amanda. If people want to continue the conversation, which I'm pretty sure they will, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I am on LinkedIn. Come find me there, and I would be more than happy to continue to nerd out on this stuff.
Awesome stuff. It's been a great conversation, and I could probably talk about this stuff for 2 hours because you never really stop being a recruiter. When I think back over the course of this conversation, the key question that we are thinking about is what do TA organizations, talent acquisition organizations, need to do in the age of AI? Because the ability to fake a candidate to get access to your environment is only going to get better. And I think the biggest thing that stands out from this conversation is that you need to get over the ickiness of treading the line of being creepy, because you have to understand what your business objectives are. And you also have to keep an eye on the customers that you serve and the impact of a breach on those customers, because you have a loose process. So when you frame it in that perspective, I think the important things that come out of the conversation is that if you want to bridge the gap between candidate experience and having a tight process, being upfront and transparent is going to go a long way in people being able to swallow the steps that they have to take to get in position to have a role there. Connecting the why of the business to the what and the how that you're doing and the process that's there, that's going to be important too. And I don't make a habit of sounding like Simon Sinek. This is an HR conversation. It kind of goes with the territory. So when you're striking that balance between candidate flow and candidate quality, it always makes sense to err on the side of candidate quality, because if you're just focusing on the quantity side, you open yourself up to a lot of risk. So learned a lot in this conversation. I appreciate you sharing that with us. For those of you who have hung out with us and listened to this conversation, make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and then tune in next time where we'll have another HR leader sharing with us how they plan on responding and transforming the HR function in the age of AI.
Hey, it's Thomas again. One quick question before you go. Are you and your HR team tired of answering the same employee questions again and again in Slack? If yes, our Cleary AI-powered Slackbot is here to help. It takes routine employee requests and answers it automatically while freeing up time for you to take on more important tasks. At the same time, it automatically builds up an HR knowledge base as you go. It's quick to set up, works right in Slack, and you can try it for free. Just head on over to gocleary.com/HR-chatbot to install it. It's again, gocleary.com/HR-chatbot. Thanks again.